John, welcome to the Life in Recovery podcast. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you.
And you were just saying that you're currently working for the Hep C Trust.
I work in I work West Yorkshire wide with four hospitals and stuff, and it's for me it's I worked in drug treatment for 15 years, and then being given chance to set up a project from scratch and watch it grow. It's kind of, like, 'cause you have all that self-doubt that you sit back one day and think, wow, I can't believe that I've been able to do this. Because we all have that big stick that says, we're not good enough, imposter syndrome, so it's kind of like that, because I always got told at school that, well, I'll be quite honest with you, my teachers knew exactly where they were going when I were at school, and that were prison. And they told me that quite they told me that a few of them and stuff, and that's what did happen, and I could never kind of how can I say this, I could never admit that until I seen the light and think, you know what, and I go back a little bit and think, do you know what, they were right, they could see my future before I could,
So
and that's the thing, in it, for me. So it's just, yeah, it's been interesting. It's been interesting.
where was that then? Where did you grow up, and how did you end up in prison?
So, I grew up in Brighouse in West Yorkshire, and I'm 50 this year. I'm 50 in 12 weeks. So it's I remember taking my first drink at 8 years old. My life were kind of, up until then, my grandparents, my dad's parents were very religious and churchgoers and stuff, and that were my little getaway. I'd spend time with my grandparents, and I'd, were brought up quite religious, Methodist, and went to church, were in church choir, Sunday school, that kind of stuff. And then my mum's side of family were working class and probably atheist and agnostics, and like to go down working men's club, and that's the thing, innit? I'm surrounded by alcohol, at a young age, so it's like it becomes normality, doesn't it? You just think, people use it for happiness, sadness, having a good time, and it becomes norm, doesn't it? So I was kind of like surrounded by that. But my dad's side of family, like my grandma and granddad and that, you never really seen it. You might have seen a sherry at Christmas, so like you might be at a coffee morning with all your aunties and stuff like that, and they're all having a cup of coffee and a slice of cake, what the bed. And then, like my mum's side of family, they're in working men's club and they work hard all week, and then they're in that drinking culture. For me, it's I like the effect produced by alcohol. I do. It says it in one of the books. I do. And this is the thing, innit? I was 8 years old and I picked up my first drink. I can remember it like my sister, she was six. I can remember it. It's just it's still there, and that effect is just sneaking this can upstairs and just having a drink. It was just it were it I like the effects that it gave me. And little did I know that it'd take me to some places in the next 28 years of my life. Like a prison, psychiatric units, hospitals, a lot of violence. It's like you don't think that it's gonna pan out like that, do you?
Not when you're 8 years old, especially.
No, like, and then, at school and stuff, it's kind of I learned a few things then as well, like. We're on front page at local paper for going into school. I found 36 bottles of contaminated wine. I must have been about 13, 14, and thought it'd be a good idea to, like bunk off and take a few of my schoolmates and stuff and have a little bit of a party. And a few of them ended up in hospital, like in quite a serious way with alcohol poisoning. And I went in and caused a riot at school. And then before you know it, like it's on front page at local paper and stuff like that. But you still don't have an idea that you might have a problem with alcohol. That's the thing in it, you know. Like I started, you know, I start, and this is where all offending, my offending and stuff started as well. You know, at a young age, alcohol related. You know, just getting in trouble, bits of criminal damage, spray paint, and all that kind of stuff. It's
You're like a Dennis the Menace type character.
yeah, definitely on one side. I always look at it like this. It's that kind of. You know, peace and tranquility on one side, and then on the other side there were just chaos. So like when I used to go up to you know, my grandparents up, because I used to have to go up there for my school dinner and stuff like that. You know, it was like my little getaway, if you know what I mean. It was kind of, but always brought me back to some normality out of the chaos, because that I lived in. Do you know, like, because you know, sometimes it was just the life that I lived down there. That's because like my grandparents lived up the road. The life that I lived down there were like a Jeremy Kyle kind of. Honestly, that's, you know, like that's how I perceive it now. It was just like it were a real life Jeremy Kyle show
Yeah,
at times.
were your mum and dad alcoholic or just big drinkers?
Yes, my dad would enforce us, you know, so that it's that institution, isn't it, a drinking, you know, so it's like back in the 70s and 60s and 70s, you know, that's what it were about, wasn't it? You know, that's so that, you know, like they drunk a lot and stuff. I mean, when my dad got remarried again, you know, like this is a thing, you know, he just hardened drinker, just put it down. You know, but he were a truck driver. He were a truck driver for most of his life. And my mum likes to drink. I always look at it like this. It's just like some people can put it down and some people can't. I'm one of them unfortunates that I've got a thirst that I can't quench. You know, and the thing is that, you know, like I know this, but that's why I always go back to, you know, I like the effect produced by alcohol, because, you know, like it did things for me.
Yeah.
The other things can't, other things couldn't do. Listen, you know, I've been involved in drugs, you know, I've been addicted to heroin, physically addicted to heroin, you know, amphetamines, you know, this is a thing, you know, my younger life and stuff, you know, is that how I ended up in a psychiatric unit at 18 year old, is that, you know, I like to drink a lot, but I also like to take a lot of amphetamines, you know, so I had my first experience of psychosis at 18. In a psychiatric unit, you know, like, and this is when they were shutting all them big institutions down, you know, that, so like all the big mainstream psychiatric units were getting moved into the community. So for me, being a, I think it was about 7 stone as well at 18. So I weren't in a good condition when I went into the psychiatric hospital. But the thing is that, you know, you had a lot of all these long-term psychiatric patients in there, so it was a scary environment for someone like myself. You know, it's that all swear off, isn't it? You know, like I have this detox. I'm not going to touch drugs again. I'm not going to touch alcohol. As soon as I'm out, I'm back off again. I'm off and running.
Yeah.
You know, I'm up and running. I'm gone. You know, within, you know, I remember having an argument with a paranoid schizophrenic in there, and they had to ask me to leave at night, you know, so, and then come back the day after, you know, and I remember going down doing town visits and drinking vodka and stuff and going back, because I don't know why we have this like kind of idea that you can't smell vodka and stuff on your breath and that. I just think it's that delusion that alcoholics have, isn't it? You know, that's why I can't really smell that,
Yeah.
you know, like it's like terps. You know, so, you know, so like, so that's kind of like, you know, like my younger life was in and out of police station. You know, a lot of these old police officers had been in army and old school officers and stuff, and you know, they were always the ones that, you know, like, you need to really get your, you know, yourself together, you know, you really need to, you know, you're not a bad lad and stuff like that. But it'd always be like, I'd always be getting pinched for some just drunken disorderly or some silly little criminal damage or something like that. You know, when I were younger, so we're in and out of the juvenile court, and, you know, mum having to take me down there and getting fines and stuff. But then it's kind of like a pip on shoulder as well, isn't it? Because you get into that life a little bit.
Get a reputation.
Yeah, definitely, because around my area, like I got called that, so it's that, and then I always come back to that bit, that, I never called by my name, I just got called by that. And if anything happened in our area, I remember my mum sticking up for me one night saying, well, it can't have been him because he were in bed. But if the rope going off, it's like finger were always pointed towards me. And like at the end of the day, the thing is that I created all that at some point. So it's that's the thing, isn't it?
When was what age did you do your kind of how many times were you in prison? Multiple or just the one?
No, do you know? Do you, it's like I can remember, I can remember. Yeah, I got up to some stuff, and I can remember being a YP, and but getting put on remand. I think I just turned 17 then, and that's when strange way riots were going on as well. So, the prison system were in chaos. Because HMP Moulins had just opened and that had started rioting as well, so we're held in containers, which were police cells. Bridewell in Leeds. I mean, the Bridewell taxis were named after Bridewell in Leeds. So it's just like an old medieval bloody dungeon, to be quite honest with you. And Wakefield Police Station. No, so you were held in places like that. So then, your career starts to progress, doesn't it, really? And then through drinking, I committed a serious assault, not just myself, and ended up in, ended up this is a crazy one, because I were on pub watch scheme, and I weren't even old enough to drink. In our local area, I think it were 96 pubs I weren't allowed in, and I can always remember my dad telling me the story about my grandfather sat in, in a pub and seeing my name up top of this list, and being quite ashamed about it. But not only that, this offence that I caused, I weren't allowed in no licensed premises in the whole of the country that sold alcohol for nearly 19 months, and it's before you got tagged in them days. I were on a 7/7 curfew for nearly 19 months, where police had just come right at your house and knock on your door, and if you're not in, like they're looking for you, and you're remanded into custody. So that were my bail was not to go, my first bail was not to consume alcohol, but obviously they said they were like, how are you going to enforce that? Are you going to sit outside his door and breathalyze him? But then they came out with a bail, not allowed in any licensed premises, even a corner shop that sold alcohol. Otherwise, I'd be breaking my bail conditions. That were for 19 months.
Bet you still managed to get some though, didn't you?
Oh yeah, definitely, absolutely. I remember getting arrested, coming out of the out of a pub, and I'd not even been drinking at 9 o'clock at night, and I'm 2 hours over my curfew, and the car gets pulled, and we're getting pulled to Brighouse Police Station, and it's kind of like, and I know that it's the day before Christmas Eve, and it's like I'm gone, and I know I'm gone, and I've got some cannabis on me, and I'm shoving it down back at chair, and in the car, back at seat, and my friends are in there, and like in quick thinking, I've kind of like given a false name and stuff, and I'm just about to walk out, and my friend's kind of like having a bit of a ruckus with police, and he shouts my real name, and that's I'm done then. I'm done, so like, and it's and then they find the drugs, and obviously I put my hands up to it then as well, because like I'm thinking, right, they've got me here. But yet again, I had a really good solicitor on Boxing Day. I had to spend all Christmas locked up until Boxing Day for special court. And then, I had a good solicitor that told me life story in half an hour. I think he used to use amphetamine because he were that good. He'd do that with his tie, and then he were off. Told me life story in about half an hour, and I got bail, which I were amazed about, because but yeah, that's and then I got sentenced, I think I was just 19 when I committed that offence. I was 21 when I got sentenced, and I went to HMP Leeds, and that's the only sentence that I did. You know, I'm not saying that I haven't, you know, that I wasn't pulled in for other things later on in my life, which are war that, you know, we beat. But you know, that's the thing in it. It's a progression in it. I call it University of Crime. Once I've gone there, you know, things start to progress. You start to, you know, walk up the ladder, don't you? You know, like, and you know, a lot of.
Sorry, I was just going to say, what was your experience of being in prison? How long were you in there, and what was the experience?
I got 8 months, but you know, like my experience of being in there is, you know, like when I first went in, is like I've done some work in HMP Leeds since, and it's just, and it's kind of surreal when you go back in there as a professional, and it's, and you know, like you were in there slopping out, you know, before TVs and stuff like that, and then if you didn't want to slop out, you wanted to get on an ants wing, you went and worked in kitchens. Listen, first time I ever went in there, you know, I've got to tell you this story. It's just like, yeah, you know, so I came off D wing where they were slopping out, and I went to work in kitchen. So we're on tray washing. They always got everyone, you know, go to feed the dogs, you know, in HMP Leeds. So put me in all this chain mail and give me these chain mail gloves and this stick and stuff and a bucket of meat, right? And put me in this lift, and I go up to E wing. And I'm stood right, and I'm shouting through everything. I said, "I've come to feed dogs, right?" And everyone just starts laughing. You know, it's a joke, right? And I'm stood there in chainmail with this stick. Stick's meant to be fight dogs off, you know. Like, there's no such thing. It's just a wind up, man. You go back down to the kitchen, and everyone's just like that. And I'm just in this chainmail with stick. I've just come to feed dogs with bucket of meat, and everyone's just in stitches a thingy, you know, like, but. You know, and there were a bit of camaraderie in there as well. You know, heroin hadn't hit the prisons as bad as what it did do. You know, so that a lot of the lads in there, you know, like had smoked dope and stuff. Listen, I were in there drinking. We found ways and means to out of brew hooch and stuff like that. So, you know, I always remember Judge kind of saying, "We're going to give you a bit of a break from society, and then hopefully you might sort out your alcohol problem." You know, and when you're in there, and you know, like, and you know, brewing hooch and stuff like that, you know, because we worked in kitchens. I remember the kitchens getting spun on Christmas Day, you know, because we're on Boxing Day, because Christmas Day, the full kitchen we'd brewed hooch, and we were all kind of like a bit inebriated, serving the Christmas dinner that year in HMP Leeds, and I think they got wind of it and then just spun the kitchen and found liters of hooch. You know, so it were you know, like I'm not when you get your liberty taken away from you, whether it's a small sentence, a big sentence or anything, it's, you know, like you've got your liberty taken away from you. But you know, I'm not saying I had a great time in there, but you know, at the end of the day, it just, for me, it were kind of like the University of Crime. You know, you come out, don't you? You start to meet people, you start to get connected a little bit more. You know, and I always remember a prison officer saying to me, you know, "You'll be back." Touch wood, I never went back. Never went back. I'm not saying that I didn't have a few close shaves, because I did, you know, like, you know, but that were it, you know, that were, you know, for me, it's kind of got. I think I got to 29, and that offending behaviour had, you know, I don't know, something inside just said to me, you know what, I was sick of it, you know, sick of the lifestyle, you know, like sick of just, like, I think when you're in them circles as well, you know, there's a lot of drinking going on and drug dealing and this and that, and you know, you're not working, and it's kind of like there comes a time where you're like, for me, it's like, where's my purpose? You get fed up of, "I'll get you, you'll get me." And I were always good at prodding people. You know, I were always good at prodding people. And then when it came back, it's that thing, innit? You know, it's like, where's this going to end? Where's it ever going to end? You know, because you can find plenty of resentment in bottom of a glass, and you can go away and you can sit and you can stew on it. "I'll get you, you get me," and it's that kind of mentality that goes on and on and on, and it's just like, when will it end? You know, when does it end? And that's the thing, isn't it?
I was gonna say that a lot of people don't get out of that lifestyle. So what
No.
was the difference with you? Like how did you avoid, because you said that you're kind of sick of the lifestyle. So how did you kind of change your circumstances and avoid getting dragged deeper into that life?
Do you know what? I think for me, like is that, got into some bother with some lads, like self, for me it were all self-made, like got involved in things and stuff, and because it is, isn't it? Sometimes you're all friends together and then it only takes one argument and then people take sides and it's like this, and then especially when you come from a small town. And then you think that your loyalties lay somewhere else and their loyalties lay, and then before you know it, you're all at each other's throats. And I think, for me, I think that's kind of where it came from, that where I've been. And I could be an instigator of things. I'm not no angel, like that's the thing, isn't it? I fitted in quite well. I weren't one of these guys that, like a year that, oh well, I didn't really fit in. I fitted in like a glove at times. If I could manipulate something and I'd cause things. I'm not saying that I wouldn't, like, and then that's it, in it, and then it's you're just in that circle, and it's just like you're watching your back for everything, and it becomes tiring, and it just becomes tiring. And I won't forget this, because at 29 year old, it's I moved over at my friend's in Huddersfield, and his mum, God bless her, like she passed away of cancer, but she helped set up a domestic violence charity, like, and I always remember, because I did need some help, like, she's got into sniffing cocaine quite heavily and got into drinking. I'd always been a bit a drinker. But people always kind of like try and put, well, you don't drink continuously, you don't do this, you don't do that. It's progression, isn't it? It's progression. I could have spurts, starts. I'd start, like, and I'd have little like sprees, and then I'd stay off it, and then I'd have bigger sprees, and I always remember, like just being up there, and like I really wanted to kind of like try and find a way out, and my friend's mum, like I remember her taking me down to the local drug service, and I always remember going in there, and I just looked at everyone, and I didn't go back for 6 months. Thought, like, just I can't do this, like, because at that point it was full of anxiety, full of fear. I'd not been used to being in that kind of environment anyway, and admitting that I had some kind of problem. I remember going to alcohol groups as well. I went to some alcohol groups, and like learned how to try and control drinking, and like, and I'm a firm believer, one cap don't fit all. Some people, like, still get enjoyment out of using, and some people can handle it and be weekend players, and some people enjoy, like, it's not, I don't think all of us get to that point where it's like, this is serious, I need to, I'm killing myself, and for me, I didn't go back down there for 6 months, and then she took me back down again, and I got involved in service user involvement. This is 21 years ago I got involved in service user involvement, like when it was separate to drug services, so it were an independent vo body, an independent voice made up of current service users, people that were on prescription drugs, some people that were abstinent, some people that were still using and stuff, and they all had a voice. And we worked closely with drug action teams in them days, and we helped to shape the local Kirklees service, which were Lifeline at the time. And it was the first service in the whole of the country, I believe, that you could walk in. This is how we helped to design this service. You could walk in and get every bit of service that you needed, from criminal justice to needle and syringe, to structured daycare. As a result of going out and doing, I think we did two bits of research: Are You Being Served? And Stairway to Heroin. You know, and I remember in them days, you know, like because my mental health from a young boy anyway had never been, it never ever been, you know, like I'd always been under some psychologist or psychiatrist from being probably 13. I'd try to take my life quite a few times, you know, like, and I'm not one of them that'll just think that I'll go off and do it. You know, I remember in a police cell, you know, exactly the same, you know, it's there, you know, like, and they were kind of concerned about me. You know, because I were in crisis, I were being in crisis, you know, being in crisis. And you know, I don't talk about my childhood that much because, you know, like today, you know, that trauma, I've recovered from that trauma today. You know, I've learned how to box it off and put it to one side and stuff like that. You know, that this is a thing, you know. So it's like, so all this other stuff give me a purpose. You know, because I think deep down inside, there's always something inside that says, you know, like I am worth a little bit more than what I think I am. You know, that's because instead of just like, because there were times where I just felt like worthless. You know, like I'm not even worth anyone's time or effort because I always thought I were a failure. You always have that little niggling thing in back of you. And I remember, you know, like I stood up front speaking to, I think it was something like 80 odd delegates around dual diagnosis and how I'd been treated, you know, trying to kind of get some support for what, you know, I'd always go in a psychiatrist and they'd always say, well, you know, you need to stop drinking or you need to stop taking drugs first. We can't treat. And I never got it, you know, like, and I'd kick off because I were very, how would I say, you know, like I were very defensive, aggressive. I always had that know-it-all attitude. And, you know, like if I didn't get my own way, you know, I'd do it in other ways. I'd stamp my feet and stuff like that, you know, until you kind of like give in to me. But you never get anywhere being like that anyway. And that were kind of like my experience of being in mental health services until, you know, like now I kind of get that I have to have a clear mind to kind of really get a grip of, you know, what might be underlying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I was going to ask you actually, what is your thought on it now? Because you said that you stood up in front of all these people and gave your experience. So is that because I work in the substance use field myself. So I this is a constant bugbear of mine, and also something that I'm continuously and I've been talking about for the last 8 years. Is that in your opinion the case that in order to have your mental health dealt with, you do have to put down the substances first?
You know, I, you know, like coming back, you know, because like a lot of this stuff now, you know, like I've seen it swaying towards trauma-based stuff in it, you know, like, you know, and you know, for me, you know, like there were a lot of past stuff that, you know, that post-traumatic stress disorder kept reliving, childhood, certain things. I'll get into it a little bit about, you know, how I broke in my career as well when I first started in my career, but. You know, like stood in front of them guys. You know, you want someone to be able to be approachable, humanistic. You know, and try and understand that. You know, like you're trying to combat your mental health, and try and self-medicate it with other substances. You know, but it was a really hard kind of bag to call with some of the practitioners that you were up against. You know, and but this is where service user involvement for me were really good, is that, you know, that we're sometimes that we could get up in front of these guys and really give them that lived experience view of what we'd experienced as patients trying to get some clarity on his mental health. I'll jump forward a little bit, but I always remember, you know, at 36-year-old Dr. Waddington saying to me, you know, like, listen, you know, you've been on medication for 23 years of your life. We're gonna have to go we're gonna go psychological route now. And I was like, listen, do you know what? I'll get to it, but I said, I'll go and do it myself. You know, because it just like I've been on one medication to other, and you know, like, if I get to this, so like from the service user involvement. it really gave me a purpose and stuff. And you know, there were a lot of service user involvement around in the country, Morph and stuff like that from Southampton and Oxford User Forum and you know, and Calderdale User Forum, who turned into Basement Projects, and you know, went on to grow. You know, like we worked along with Methadone Alliance and stuff like that as well. And you know, and for me, you know, like it gave me a sense of purpose, and it were an inroad into starting to work in services. You know, so I started to work in services in 2005 as a young person's. A trainee young person support worker because I volunteered with young people. Because that were another area that I felt I always had doors closed, you know, like with the dual diagnosis and the substance use, you know, trying to get some help, you know, where do I end up? You know, at a young age, I'm in a psychiatric unit. They weren't the provision then that there is now a drug services, you know, like they were very underfunded and not as well, not as accessible as what they are now, I don't think. You know, so it's like I started to work in what in one of these services, you know, with young people and stuff. And you know what, I really enjoyed it. But you know, like when you're carrying the baggage from your youth and from your childhood, the thing is that you want to become a saver. Well, you want to save everyone else and you forget about yourself, John, don't you? And the thing is that I could channel all that stuff and forget about what were going on for me, which were dangerous. And you know, like I think it were about 2 years in, and I did a DVD called Crossing the Line. It went into schools with another 3 people, and it weren't about telling people that they shouldn't be doing drugs or all that. It was. We got our point across is that, you know, what if we had a, you know, what if we had a made different choices, you know, in his life. And you know, it won an award off Frank, actually, off government, you know, like and I always remember that getting showcased and stuff like that. So we're always put on this kind of pedestal, you know, and then you know, like you know, like I don't know whether it's a male thing, but you don't ever want to show any weakness or anything like that, do you? Like you're less than, or you're struggling, or I can't really hold my hands up here, and stuff's going on for me. And it's just, I remember that, you know, the drug action team had done a load of videos around a young person's thing and some scenarios around alcoholism and home life and stuff. And I remember just seeing this one thing, and it tipped me over edge. Honestly, it just brought all this stuff back from my childhood. You know, and I hit it. I hit it. I was drinking 80 units a day, you know, like, and I were mentally unwell again. And I ended up 33-year-old, ended up in psychiatric unit, you know, at St. Luke's in Huddersfield. And, you know, and it were a struggle, you know, like it were a real struggle because, you know, like I were eating, I was self-harming that way, I was cutting myself. But I was going into work as well. And this is the thing, you know, like, and kind of just crying out for help a little bit, and they were trying to be professional and didn't know how to deal with me that way. You know, I didn't really realize how ill I was, John. You know, like this is a thing. I didn't really realize all this traumatic stuff that I'd been through, and you know, regurgitated it from just going in there and watching this video, and how complex, you know, like that. That's how much that triggered just something in me that just like I just wanted to die. That is the honest truth, you know. And there I am again, you know, like, and I'm in a psychiatric unit, you know, for a couple of weeks. We guys that, you know, I've known, who I've grown up with, that are in adult drug services, that know that I'm a drug worker, saying, you know, what are you doing in here? And it's just like, listen, man, I'm a human being. You know, I'm broken at this moment in time. I were broken. I always remember coming out and HR coming up to my house, and I didn't like what they said, but you know, I get it today. You know, like we don't know whether you're going to be a danger to them young people, or they're going to be a danger to you. You know, after what else? But I didn't want to hear that because you know I've come out of this psychiatric unit, and I didn't realize how ill I were at that point. But thinking, how dare you come to my house and say that to me? Do you know what? You know, I weren't fit for work, John. I were, you know, like, but you know, that there's something in there, isn't there, that, you know, like, and it were kind of like, I just felt, I can't believe that you've just said that to me, you know, that after what I've just been through, I'm well enough to go, well, do you know what? I didn't go back to work for 3 months. I actually went to see an addiction psychologist. What Lifeline. I held real deep resentment against Lifeline for all this stuff until I really seen the truth in it, John. I'm an honest man. I did until I really seen the truth in it, that they were just trying to protect me. And they did, and they did a fantastic job of that. But I didn't really realize, you know, that at the time, that they were trying to make sure that I was keeping myself safe. But I always remember going back to work 3 months later, and I had to, you know, like, it's when we had paper files and I'm having to put bits of paper in and stuff. And I remember one at Senior Prax going, man, this is just a waste, John. Can you go downstairs and give a script out and stuff like that? Because I'd always been good around that stuff, you know, like of engagement. That's what I were, an engagement and harm in worker. And I were good at working with young people as well. You know, I put 110% in. But you know, the thing is that I carried my demons into that and channeled, you know, helping other people to push my stuff down at once and think that, you know, that's going to save me. Didn't.
I think a lot of people in services do. So
Yeah.
I see that. I do see that in services even to this day, that I think a lot of people that are, you know, either in recovery from some form of addiction or maybe they've not dealt with that stuff, use the role in
Yeah.
helping people to avoid dealing with their own stuff. So I get that completely. And like, when you said, you know, you're being put on a pedestal on the one hand, but on the other hand, you're really struggling and you didn't like know how to express that. It's funny because my whole shtick when it comes to addiction and recovery, and this is something that I talk about all the time, is for me, anybody can become an addict at any time.
Yeah.
It's the underlying emotional issues that we have an inability to deal with that then become mental health issues
Yeah.
that we then medicate with substances or behaviors. And that is it. Like, that is the way I explain addiction to anybody. And I don't think that, I'm not sure. I mean, I'd like to ask your opinion on this, because I'm not sure that the people that run run treatment services, and especially like the government, I don't think that they understand that addiction is that. What do you think?
No, you know, can you see? Right, I remember when I first started in services, right, I weren't allowed to talk about my experience. None of us were, you know, there were quite a few of us in there because there were none of this lived experience stuff. You know, like, I think, you know, like, I had really good relationships with commissioners and stuff that kind of understood. They liked this kind of stuff because it came from, you know, that understanding of being there, seeing it, worn the t-shirt. You know, and sometimes, you know, sometimes for me, and I love what you've just said there, is that you know, we do have a lot of people that just want to go in and try and make a difference. You know, and sometimes we forget, don't we? You know, like that. Sometimes, you know, like, who are we making a difference to? Is it us or is it them? You know, like, the thing is, you know, like, for me, I just think sometimes, like, that this I'll answer this question, what you've just said, that sometimes the government and you know, people in services, you know, that we become a number, we become data, we become this, we become that, and you know, we forget, you know, like, this is the exact reason, and it's no one's fault. It's no one's fault. People are under so much pressure nowadays because they've got this target, there's this target, there's mental health, there's safeguarding, there's risk, you know, there's a risk of overdose and stuff like that. And you know, like, if you think about it, and you've worked in service, you're like, constantly, where's that person in middle of that?
Yeah.
Where are the two people in middle of that? Where are you? And where's that person that's come to you for a service? You know, for me, it's kind of like, do the government and do, you know, higher management understand that, you know, like, you're dealing with some very broken people, some very complex people, you know, like for me, you know, now I can work in this environment because I can understand where I've been from and I've healed. I've done a hell of a lot of work on myself. You know, that experience of being a drug worker and ending up in a psychiatric unit, broken and drinking 80 units a week, and then I'm trained in all this stuff, trained in CBT, I'm trained in solution focused, motivational interviewing, all this stuff, right? Can't pull myself out of it. I could not pull myself, but I've got this idea that maybe I can, and if I say this to you, this went on, right? Another about 7 years when I became abstinent as a drug worker, and I battled alcoholism, John. I battled alcoholism as a drug worker. And you know what? Sitting there, and I love what you've just said there, sitting there, and there were times that I identified more with the people that I'm sat in reception with and disclosed a little bit more than what I should have been at times, because I am one of them.
Yeah, you want more one of them than you are the drug worker.
Yeah, and I still, I've got boundaries, and I'm Northern Safeguarding Lead for us, and I'm a manager now, but I never take myself off that seat because I know what it's like to sit on that seat. And the thing is that, at that point, it were a dangerous point time for me. I weren't bringing my alcoholism into work at that point, but the thing is that it were there. I couldn't wait to get away and drink and drink and drink, and it got worse and worse and worse, and it got to the point where, I'm going missing. I'm booking days off work. My mum's ringing round everywhere. That's what I, my last drinking before I got abstinent, my last drinking session, I went out with the old commissioners because they were all leaving, and I had this intention of just having one drink. I'm having one drink, I came round on the Monday night from the Thursday, not knowing where I'd been or anything. And you're sat there sometimes, trying to help other people to get out of what you're sat in, and how much you feel a fraud.
Yeah.
Because you can't live up to what you're trying to teach some of these guys to try and do. And I think sometimes we've got to be real, because I've always been real and always try to tell people where I've been and what I've done, even as an employee, of the mistakes that I've made, the things when I've been put on a pedestal, and the big falls that I've had. Because I've seen people come from being volunteers, right, and get put on a pedestal and get work in drug services and then die.
Yeah, me too. I know lots of people that have
Yeah.
fortunately gone down that route. And part of that though, I think and again, I don't have any answers to this. This is just an
No.
observation and maybe an opinion is maybe there should be more stringent safeguarding of people that are coming into the serv into services because if somebody's doing what you were doing back then. They're working with vulnerable people, and actually they're an alcoholic themselves. Surely something should be in place to kind of prevent that from happening,
Yeah. Exactly, and for me there, isn't it? It's like exactly like what you said, I've come into this service, right? Of being, coming out of a life of chaos from being such a young boy. I ain't been no angel. I'll never thingy. I've done things in my life that, most of us like that I'm not proud of or anything like that. But I've hope I turned a corner, because really, and I can't excuse some of the stuff that I've done in my past. But it's there. That's exactly where it is. It's the past. But I come into service, and they totally understand who I am. They totally understand where they've picked me up from. And I believe we need to be nurtured, and I love what you've just said there, like a package to kind of like nurture people. We have people, Like you have people that might have never been in education before. Like, listen, I were a fickle lad at school, but I just used to like to stick my fingers up at teachers and say, I ain't doing what you told me to do. I was totally anti-establishment. I knew better than everyone else, and I kicked myself when I got older. Because this is a thing, but we have some guys that come into employment that have been in hardcore addiction that it's hard for them to switch a computer on and understand what and then but what we've got, I think what you've got to think about then is how they feel around that, because I've just said about it and our pride and stuff like that. I don't really want to show any weak. That's exactly what I will like. I remember I used to go into supervision and used to say, how are you, John? I'd be like, yeah, I'm fine. Look what happened, 33 year old, I'm in a psychiatric unit. Yeah, I'm all right, I can handle this. I can't show any weakness here, man. So they might think I can't do a job. Oh, I'm gone.
This is the reason why middle age suicide rates are highest in middle-aged men, because it's not just people that have fallen into addiction.
No.
This is a societal thing, isn't it? Like, men don't talk about the way that they feel. They get to a certain age, probably mid-20s, early 30s, they've never spoken about the way that they feel. When they start encountering difficulties in life, you get more responsibilities, you've got kids, you've got jobs, you've got all sorts of stuff. And those emotional issues then ramp up and become stress, anxiety, depression, other mental health issues that are more serious. And before you know it, they're either in addiction because they're using alcohol and drugs or gambling or sex or whatever it is to change the way they feel, or they're hanging themselves by a rope or jumping in front of a train, and that's the bit that I don't think society really gets. Is
No.
actually it boils down to, but what it actually boils down to is having these types of conversations, really.
De definitely. De
You're being honest,
definitely.
you're sat here telling your story and being honest, vice versa. And whether it's on a one-to-one basis or on a group base on it, in a group setting, that's what people need.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I could go into my childhood and stuff, but you know what? We've healed. We've all healed. My family's healed around it. It's there, like, we've all forgiven each other, and it is what it is, and it happened, and we can't get away from it. And maybe it had a little bit of an influence on how I turned out. But I had kind of a bigger influence on how I turned out as well, because you hear it all the time, don't you? You might have some siblings that are in the same family that don't even go down the road that the other sibling goes down, so I can't, I've never been kind of like, one that's been like that. I just needed to heal. I just needed to find that stuff for me. And it's like I say, so for them 6.5 years, 7 years of battling alcoholism, and then I go on that spree, and then I come out of that spree, and believe it or not, right? It's 30th of March 2010, and it were an Easter bank holiday weekend, and we're coming up to the exact same Easter bank holiday weekend, and that were the time, that something inside me shifted, and it said to me, listen, I can't do this anymore, man. I looked in the mirror, I weren't even there, and I always remember, like that. So I'm under my bed and crying, because what you've got to remember is alcohol had become my best friend. It had ruined most of my relationships. It had taken most of my jobs. I've been in prison for it. I've been in psychiatric units for it, and everything. You know what I mean? Me and alcohol have been through a hell of a lot. So for me to get to that point of like, listen, I'm going to lose my best friend here. What's my life going to be like? Like, I couldn't see my life without it. But the best thing is that I persevered, and I always remember, and it's this little thing that I had a choice that day, and it's weird, like, I could have walked onto the Sainsbury's shop when I was living in Huddersfield, but I took a right-hand turn, and I went to a sandwich shop. I've been on a bender for 5 days, man. I ain't eating. I don't even know where I've been for 5 days, until my mate dropped me off. Trying to break into my own house that had been open for 5 days. I come back with a sandwich. I don't even eat it. And there's some kind of shift inside me that says, like, I need to crack on now. But do you know what? For 9 months, right, I didn't have a drink, and I held on for dear life, because I was a nightmare at work. because I didn't know how to handle myself emotionally, you know, especially my temperament. You know, were quite aggressive. I were quite arrogant. Do you know what? I had all these mixed emotions going on for 9 months, and I always remember my manager saying, "You know what? We're gonna have to move you from this site to the next site across there because you're just upsetting people, John. What's going?" And 1 minute I'm laughing, next minute I'm crying, and I just don't know what's going on. You know what, John? I'm gonna drink again. That's what's coming in because that's my routine. You know, like it's been. You know, like I get a little bit of time off. I think I've cracked it. And then that insidious idea will come, and I think, right, yeah, I'll be all right. What get me this time? And then before you know it, 2.5, 3 years have gone.
Yeah.
And I'm in the midst of it all. You know, and this is a thing in it, and mental health's not really good. And it's like I say to you know, like I'm 36 year old then, and it's kind of like I go to see a psychiatrist because I've been on these medications, anti-anxiety, it's all this thing, it's really high. And he's like, "We need to go to psychological route, Jim." I always remember this because, you know, like and I did, and I went the spiritual way. You know, I went the only way that I thought that I could recover, because that's what I do. And I say, you know, I class myself as a recovered alcoholic. I've recovered from the hopeless state of mind and body today. You know, the problem's been removed. As long as I keep in fit spiritual condition, that's how you know, that's me. I'm not being arrogant or egotistical. It's just that as long as I can maintain what I've got today, you know, that's the thing. And I remember 36 year old, I said to me, psychiatrist, says, "Listen, I'm going to India for 6 months, man." You know, and I asked work for a sabbatical, and best thing that I ever did, you know, like, and I shot off and I met this guy, right? I didn't even like him when I first met him, neither, you know, like, but he helped me, you know, showed me a different way of life and how to cope with John, you know, and you know, and have a look at all them flaws that, you know, like that I had, you know, and really process them and really work on them, you know, to the point of where, you know, like, what? In next 2 weeks, I'm 14 years abstinent, you know, and that's the guy that sat on the end of his bed once my best friend had been taken away from me, wondering what's my life gonna be like. You know, 18 months in, I'm traveling India and I have such an experience, and you know, I come back a different person. You know, like, you know, first person I had to amend my behavior to was my mum. You know, like, because I always pointed the finger and said, "You've done this to me." You know, like, and I were financially, mentally, physically aggressive towards that woman. But you know what? She'll do well for me. I'm sat in her house now, you know, like, because, you know, like, after a 10-year relationship, you know, you know, we've decided to take a break. You know, but I can do that as a grown-up today and think, you know, there's no animosity in it. There's no, "You've done this, you've done that, you." Do you get where I'm coming from? You know, like this is the stuff that I've grown into. You know, this is, you know, like, this is the best version of all who I always wanted to be when I was that little boy at my grandma's, or sat in coffee morning, or sat in church. You know, that's the thing in it, you know, like trying to be as selfless as I can.
So what
You know,
happened when you went to India? I mean, like, so that's.
Yeah, so like this is a great story, right? So I was like, I've never been out of this country since I was 2 year old. So like, prior to that, I went to Menorca just because I'd not flown since I was a kid, you know, for my birthday about a couple of months before, and then I just booked a trip to India. I didn't have nowhere, an hotel or anything booked, right? I docked down in Mumbai at 4 o'clock in the morning. I always remember my dad dropping me off at Manchester Airport and going up things, and we got that male pride, haven't we? I don't want to look back. I want to cry, man, because I'm just like, oh, I can't turn back now. I can't. I'm going, and you know, and I get on that plane and I dock down at in Mumbai at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's just like I get taken to this hotel, and I never forget in that first morning I were there, and I now know that it's in Bandra, which is the other side of Mumbai, which is, I open these curtains and it looks like Beirut outside. And I'm like, oh, wow, man, what have I done? What have I done? You know, and But the best thing about what how we live, in recovery is that I've got a phone number. I've got a phone number of a stranger that I've never met before, but we've got a common purpose that we've all suffered from the same, spiritual illness for me. We've all been there, like we've been to the depths of despair, and I pick that phone up and they come. And like I travel India for 6 months on my own.
Were these members of the fellowships then?
And they're still they're still great friends today.
Were you in the fellowship at that point then? Or did you like
We're in fellowship at that point.
so before you went to India, you'd kind of made a decision. Had you how long have you been in AA for that at that point then?
Well, I'd been in other fellowships,
Okay.
so I'd been 9 months, 9 months, because I were bouncing around as a dry drunk for 9 months, and it's going to happen again because that's it's, whether people believe it or not, right? I identify with what that book talked about. Because that's someone's, that is my experience, and I have had my own experience out of that book, so I can identify this is going to happen again. This is going to happen again. It doesn't tell me that it's never going to happen again. It's going to happen again. So it's just like, this is where I meet a man that shows me that book, that enlightens me, that wakes me up spiritually, that gives me a different outlook on my life, and I come that this is what I'm saying. I come back, like that I can live my life without what I've just left behind, and I travel India for it for and I think it's I traveled India for 6 months, man. I'm up at a big convention in mountains, man, in Mumbai, only a European there. And and these are all great friends, and friends. I'm in book studies, man, in Bangalore and stuff like that. It was just like I'm staying in a sobriety house with 6 or 7 other guys, that go to meetings every day, and I'm laid on these bunks with them, and go to meetings with them, and just really experiencing. Listen, I get taken to a rehab. I've never been in anything as frightening in my whole life, man. Under lock and key. I'm in this big dorm, and then upstairs I've got people up there with psychiatric problems that they're not even medicating because they believe, like this is it doesn't tell us in that, but they believe that this stuff's gonna get them well from it. But like that's it doesn't say that anywhere. But I always remember, going to a friend Mahesh, listen, I need to go, man. I can't this in like I can't stay here, he wanted me to do some work because at that point, I'd been a worker for quite a while, but I just didn't believe in that lock and key kind of stuff.
Yeah, just
You know,
took
like,
prison.
yeah. And I said to him, I said, "What happened if you opened door?" I said, "Most of them have run off." So like when you were in rooms around there, that's when you used to see. That's why I used to see a lot of aggression, towards family members. You'd hear a lot of resentment. And I could never understand until I went to that place, and I kind of like understood that these guys had been, dragged kicking and screaming against their own will, just like straight in there and under lock and key. So I could understand why they were all resentful. And do you know what? I was there last year, in November to see some of my friends. I were in Russia. I went to Russia. Your fellowship, and it, and in 2012 came back. I met a load of guys out there in India from Russia, and what an experience driving around Moscow in sports cars and stuff like that. Like I remember being a kid wanting to stand on Red Square, and it happened. I wouldn't have done that if I was still drinking.
You know, for people that are watching this, so like a lot of people, that was like I could tell from obviously from the language that you were using that you are a member of a fellowship. And for people that are watching this that aren't might not necessarily, there's a lot of people that watch this podcast that aren't necessarily in addiction or know people that are, or you know, that they've got different experiences and stuff. So the literature of the fellowships kind of teaches us that if we follow this program, we'll have a spiritual awakening, and as a result of doing the program. And And that spiritual awakening will mean that we can then live life on life's terms, essentially. At what point did you have that spiritual awakening? Was it prior to going to India, or is it when you were in India, do you think?
Think, do you know when I first had that spiritual awakening, right? Is that time was, you know, before I'd even come into them rooms, is that when I was sat on that 30th of March, something shifted in me that at that point, you
Yeah.
know, like, so for me later on, all what it talks about in that book about spiritual experiences, I had a number of spiritual experiences, but the biggest spiritual awakening that I had is when I hit that number 12. You know, and it talks about it, doesn't it? You know, it talks about it for me. It talks about, you know, practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know, and this is a thing. What are all my affairs in my employment, in my home life, in my friendships, in my relationships? You know, and I'm being of service to others, not just in what we do, but in every area of my life. You know, like it's being thoughtful, isn't it? You know, like do I drop something on the floor? You know, like for me nowadays, that doesn't happen. It's in the bin, you know, because that's someone else has got, or, you know, like my mum's garden gets a bit, you know, people just go like that and, you know, oh, someone else can do it. You know, like it's that consideration of others, isn't it? Because I never consider anyone but myself. You know, the powerlessness stuff for me is that, you know, I had to find a power greater than myself because I was the only power that run in my life for all them years was me. Because I played God with my life so much and other people's lives that I understand what powerlessness means. You know, I have to find a power, you know, like, and you know, for me, if I'm going to connect with something greater than myself, because I always thought I was the greatest, that's it. You know, I've got to find a power greater than myself. For me, it's just like, you know what? I love what it says, that terminology, universe of the spirit. You know, you're out there, aren't you? You know, like, and you're surrounded by like-minded people. You know, like I, an experience the other week. You know, I were walking up Beeston, and I'm going for the bus one Sunday morning, and you could, and you know, like I hate all this divide and that they've got in this country and stuff now. And you know, like there were an African lady walking down, and I said good morning, and she was kind of like really shocked, but you know, then she had courage to ask me, you know, like, oh, do you know where so and so is? And I said, oh yeah. If you just go around that way and that way, you know, because like people aren't used to doing things like that nowadays, are they? It's good morning, you know, walking, being pleasant and polite, holding a door open and stuff like that. Because I never used to do anything like that. You know, that this is that that's the spiritual awakening for me means, you know, like that I became a dead spirit. You know, for all them years, and then something awoke that spirit in me. You know, and I always look at it like this: the main problem of John centers in his mind. You know, the main problem of John centers in his mind. If I'm God-centered, it starts from there. My motives run from there, not there. And if they run from there, they're normally sweet.
Yeah, that's how I always look at it as well. Like
Yeah.
the ego's up here, and the
Yeah.
heart is where the love
Isn't
comes
it?
from. Yeah.
And I got halfway through, right, and I lose my purpose and I start to rebuild again, and John's back, and I'm in collision with everyone, and then before you know it, right, I'm suicidal again. It's not that I'm going to drink again, it's that I don't want to be here. You know, I'm in a job and my caseload's absolutely through roof, and you know, I can't manage it. It's first time my caseload's been in red, and I've got that going on, and then it's, I always remember, you know, like I always remember saying to me, you know, like I think I've cracked this. I don't think I need to go to them places anymore. And I always remember her just like looking at me like I've, you know, I think he's gone insane again. You know, and I always remember asking, because I'd not spoken to the person that were helping me for nearly 18 months at that point, because you know, like I were, you know, trying to get by on my self-will again, and it weren't panning out, because I always remember her asking me, John. She says to me, she says, what is wrong with you? And we got this pride, haven't we, as males and that. I ain't letting you have a little bit of what's going on for me. And then all of a sudden it opens up and it's like, do you know what? I don't want to be here. I sit on bus every day. I just don't want to be here. Said every time I'm waiting for a train, I just want to put my foot straight over and I'm scared. Do you know, and that's 7 years in, and do you know what? I made a promise to myself that I weren't going to get in that state again, John. And that's not just about the fellowship stuff. That's about growing as a person, isn't it? That's about looking at other areas of my life where I can grow spiritually. You know, that's thing in it. You know, it's what it talks about, mind, body, and spirit. You know, they all need to be aligned, don't they, for me?
Well, the crazy thing about your story, is it's so similar to mine. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
The amount of people's stories who I've heard that that they hit that kind of rock bottom, like you said, on the did you say the in March, 30th of March.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly the same for me.
Yeah.
7th of September 2009.
Yeah.
I did exactly the same thing. I woke up in the morning, and I just knew I couldn't do it anymore. Just said that to myself over and over again, and eventually, like, I got down on my knees and I just started praying, and I just said, "Please help me, because I can't do this anymore." And I've never
Yeah.
had a drink ever since. And similar to you, it didn't all happen like overnight. Like, I
No.
didn't go into the fellowship for another year, but all the stuff that you've said, and all the, A, the spiritual awakening happened.
Yeah.
B, when I stopped doing the stuff, I started feeling suicidal again. And, that taught me that it's nothing
Yeah.
to do. The drink and the drugs is the
Yeah.
medication I use to medicate myself.
Yeah.
And if I don't do this stuff, if I don't practice the principles of the program and all my affairs, like you said, I just start feeling terrible, restless, irritable, and
Yeah.
discontent
Yeah.
initially. And then before you know it, I'm anxious, I'm depressed, and I'm really, really not in a good place. And I've had multiple experiences of that throughout the last 14 years. And it never changes. So that just proves to me that the problem is within, and it will always be there. You
And
don't.
some people don't get this stuff though, do they? You
Huh?
know, because they say it's a religious program, it's this, it's that. You know, like it is God-centered. God-centered is in there. You can't remove it from what it is. You know, like I always got taught when I first came around. You know, God's been around for centuries. You know, like before God. You know, like human beings were always worshiping something. You know, like, and that's the thing. We've always had a reliance on something, you know, like, because we always think there's something outside of us, you know. So what right have I got to say that there's, you know, like, we have got science, we have got this, we have got that, you know, like, but for me, you know, like, it's talking about faith in it and belief, you know, faith for me that, you know, like, that, you know, it's possible that I can live my life. You know, the way that I've always wanted. You know, the biggest thing that I love what you said, the biggest thing that's the peace of mind that I have today. You know, I've had a bit of a rough start to this year, but you know, like I've got a prospect and I'm watching this person grow and get little things back and that. And what a gift of being able to, you know, like person's going to come and pick me up tonight and we sit and I share a little bit of my experience and I've seen. You know, that person go from drinking 90 pints a week to getting down to 6 a day instead of 10 a day, you know, like, and it's honestly, it's just, you know, like, and listen, I ain't charging anything for that. Do you know what? It's a privilege to be able to, because I tell you something, that person's helping me more than I'm helping him at this moment in time, because if I didn't have that, you know, that's the thing, innit? If I didn't have that, you know, it's just exactly like what I've spoke about around, you know, things that have gone on for me this year. I've acted like a grown-up and I never could do that because it were always about control and how dare you do that to me? Do you know who I am? This, that. But do you know, like, to walk away from something and not have any animosity and not point the finger and kind of, you know, like, come away from it as looking at what an experience I've just had.
Yeah, and taking responsibility. You
Yeah.
take the responsibility for your part in it, don't you?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
It's and this is the thing, innit? And you know what? I've just had a I've had a fantastic 6 years working what I'm doing, and you know, being responsible for being able to say, here's a project, we want you to set this up, right, and build it, and then show what I can do, you know, with other people, and then have other people come in, and we all work as one big unit and one big team to show, you know, like what we can do and what we can achieve of being, you know, like, and most of my team are then people that are dead approachable, you know, like, because we've all lived that life and we've never taken ourselves away from it. So that's the unique thing about the FC Trust, is that we're a peer program of people with lived experience that know exactly, you know, like how to engage with the people that are marginalized, that, you know, that people walk past every day when they're in doorway. Because sometimes I don't think that a lot of places represent them people.
No. And what does life in recovery mean to you today?
Do you know what? It's life in recovery means, for me, peace of mind. It means my family's got peace of mind. It means I can be best version, you know, that I can be. I just want to finish on this story, you know, like this one morning really nearly it had me in tears, you know, like I've gone to get a coffee at Nero's in Leeds train station, you know, like, and I you know, like, and it's fair, and you know, and they offered to buy this guy a coffee, and they said, no, you can't, I'd advise you not to buy that person a coffee. And I'm like, why? Well, I'd advise you not to, he's not a nice man. You know, it's a freezing morning, right? He's been out there, you know, no matter, you know, like, we've all got judgment and stuff like that. And this is what brought society home to me at that point. Well, I don't think he's a nice man. I said, you know what? I earn this money. So if I want to buy this person a drink, a coffee, I'm going to buy him a coffee. Can I have a coffee, please? I weren't arguing about it. And do you know what? This is the best thing sometimes. I had a couple at the back of me that said, if you hadn't bought him that coffee, we would have done. You know, sometimes, you know, just because that guy's dishevelled, right? I'm not saying stealing's right or anything. He might have taken a brownie off thingy one day that he might have been hungry or something like that. You know, like you know, it's like, you know, and you're gonna judge him for that. You know, like, for me, that's what recovery means to me, is that I've never kind of stepped away from being that person that's there, stood in front of me, freezing, that's grateful that I'm grateful that I can buy him a coffee today.
Yeah, there, but for the
In
greater
it,
good, isn't it?
yeah, of course, that's the thing, in it.
For somebody that's never experienced anything like that, they've just got no clue. They've got absolutely no idea.
No.
And like you said, the word judgment, I mean, unfortunately, a natural part of the human condition is to judge, isn't it? It's to judge people. And it actually takes, I think it takes a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience to start to kind of turn the other way and to become less judgmental and more empathetic and more compassionate. Because I was exactly the same. I would never do anything for anybody in the past. I
No.
would never even think of it. I was just selfish and self-centered,
Yeah.
and I still am today, but I try my
Yeah.
best to be.
But you understand your flaws today, and that's the thing, in it. We understand these flaws, didn't we? We understand, you know, what makes us tick. But the best thing that we've been given is that we can recognize that today.
Absolutely.
You know, and the thing is, you know, like, just stretching a little hand out like that every now and again. You know, that's because, like, I spent years homeless. Honestly, you know, like, I'm pretty much, you know, like, now I'm at my mum's in spare room, and you know, it's probably all I've ever known, to be quite honest with you. You know, I could rent an house and stuff like that, but you know, like, it's nice to be able to spend some time later on with a woman I had animosity for nearly 20 odd years of my life. Now that really, that's what recovery's given me, that relationship like that with
I'm
my
sure she
mum.
appreciates having you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like that's the thing, innit? I remember bringing people here to work with, and she were always like inquisitive, and a cup of coffee here, a cup of tea there, and do they sponsor you? You sponsor them, and you know, just seeing, you know, like for your parents to see you giving something back instead of having to come and bail you out or come and see you in prison or see you in a psychiatric unit. You know, it's liberating for them as well, innit?
Massively, yeah. That's brilliant, that mate. Well, thanks very
Yeah,
much
man.
for
Yeah,
spending.
thank you, John. You know, it's been a pleasure.
Really appreciate you taking the time,
Yeah,
yeah, and
lovely.
telling everybody your story. So,
Yeah,
is there
lovely.
anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
Do you know what? If there's anyone struggling out there, you know, like the biggest thing that you can do is always hold your hand out and ask for help, man.
Yeah.
Best thing in it. Cheers, John.
Thank you.
Lovely. And you. Bye-bye.